on what might happen, and if this idea that it might be canceled gets around the plant, you're going to lose a great many people trying
to
find a way out.
If it didn't lose the people, you'd lose any energy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never could believe it, or even believe anything happening to anybody, I guess. Conservative government hoped that the program would fail and thereby die of its own, have a death anyway, so they wouldn't be faced with it. Camp Research said this to me one day. He said, of course, these fellows hope that this thing's going to be a failure and then they can blame us.
I've never heard anything of that nature from people I've talked to, ranging from Perks and Fulton and Harkness and whatnot. I've never heard that. And indeed, again, in Hansard, Perks mentioned in December 1958 at a meeting of NATO ministers trying to sell, you know, the plane to them, and then up until several weeks, I think, prior to the cancellation, it's only a couple of weeks beforehand that he also gets a final note from the Royal Air Force saying that they won't. In other words, that they're trying to sell the damn thing. And of course he's blamed for this, incidentally, by Harkness, who says what the devil is it? Oh, somewhere around here he's saying that if the CF-105 is going to be obsolete by the time it's in, you know, on the line in 1961, you are to be blamed for trying to sell the plane in the 6 or 7 months beforehand, you know, selling an obsolete plane to your good and true friends. And Harkness also blames him a couple of days later for not trying to sell the damn thing.
Harkness is on the same side, though, isn't he?
No. Harkness is the leader of the Liberal
opposition.
So that from a political point of view, they are...
Damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
You're damned if you do and damned if you don't. It's a beautiful situation. He says, among other things...
Oh, yeah.
He's saying that Canadian salesmen were not persuasive enough in the United States. Perks also mentioned that he had been down in Washington trying to talk to people there into buying it. Of course, he and a great many others condemned the government for the loss of skilled workers as a result.
Well, that, of course, is where I think that we, where we lost out.
Yeah.
A lot of our engineers helped put the man on the moon, of course.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Chief engineer went to McDonald. He was the project engineer, one of the senior project engineers on the Mercury program.
Was he Canadian?
Yeah, he was English. Lindsay.
I heard
Lindley. Lindley. L-I-N-D-L-E-Y.
I heard that something like, well over half, something like two-thirds of the technical people were British on the Arrow project.
Pretty close to it, I guess. Pretty close to it. Our Perks was in a pretty tough spot, of course.
There also came... He was. Now, he says, you know, on reflection, that it may have been his fault because he was just absolutely unable to get any more money to see the project through. And that if the money kept going out like that for the Arrow, with the fixed budget that he had.
Well, he didn't have the fixed budget, of course, then, although he had a shrinking budget, didn't he?
Yeah, well, that's what I mean, with the budget that he did have, let's put it that way, that something else would have to go. Now, what else might have gone?
Well, nothing else ever would have gone, actually.
Well, here you get there is no doubt about it, and
what did they do with the $300, $400 million a year that they allegedly saved by not doing the Arrow?
That's a good question. Of course, I know that they had whittled it down. they had saved about $174 million in the first year and a half. The budget had been cut. And of course, this, I believe, is one of the conservative election promises, that they would get more for less.
That's right.
Which is anybody's election.
Well, promise. Of course it is, and I think that they spoke without very much knowledge.
Mm.
They, I'm sure, were going to come into power and find large globules of fat lying all around the Defense Department, which is the only department that is capable of having any cuts. No department, all the other departments got pretty well fixed expenditures.
Yeah.
And welfare and all these sort of things are almost a must.
Yeah.
So the Defense Department is the only one that's really got any flexibility left. And there's where they're going to get these great globules of fat.
Yeah.
And they didn't find it. A little bit here and a little bit there. But it was just peanuts.
Going back to your...
So they had to cancel one big program. That's really what it amounted to.
But that big program, am I not correct in thinking that the expenses were going, wider and wider, and that if they didn't close that down, or at least didn't reduce it, or somehow or other get around this ever-increasing amount of money, that they would have either to have received more money or reduced somehow what was going on. And
well, it's hard for me to say because I don't know. The Arrow program would have probably cost a total of $2
billion. By 1961?
To have whatever squadrons I have in mind, like the 100 airplanes in operation.
Yeah.
And all the ground handling equipment and everything else. For the engine, the airplane, the fire control system, the missiles.
Yeah.
The whole program would have been about a $2 billion program. Which is about the biggest thing that Canada had ever done. I think it's more than the Seaway, which is the biggest thing.
Yeah, it was very close, I know, to that.
Yeah.
Or like the British Columbia Dam.
Well, these have been come along since, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, with the increase.
Yes.
Yeah.
But a $2 billion capital expenditure as an overall program. Yeah. Well, we would never have had the CF-100, you see, if we'd gone into total program costing. It would have frightened them to death, and they would have canceled that.
We were able to sell quite a few of the CF-100s, were we not?
No.
To other countries?
No. We sold about 50 to Belgium.
I thought Germany had taken some.
No.
Let me put this on.
The F-100s were sold to Belgium, I think, in 58.
Yeah. I don't have right in this book with me the extract from the perks. Description in which he gives a history of the Arrow. This is on the 23rd of February, 1959, in which he outlines the background of the Arrow from 1952 right to 1959.
In the house?
Yep. Gives a reason for cancelling.
23rd of February?
This is, yes, that's on the 23rd of February, 1959.
Well, when was it canceled?
It'd be canceled within a day or so of that date, I believe, wasn't it? Right around that time.
I thought it was the last Friday in February.
Well, that's awfully close to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That could easily be. There are... there is a... another place where the liberals have the conservatives over the barrel. It's a rather nice one, too. I believe Perks mentioned somewhere that one of the big reasons is that the information that he has, the intelligence that he has, which he's getting from the Yanks, is that the threat from the Russian bomber is lessening. with the follow on that by the time the Arrow becomes operational, that missiles will be the big threat. And Diefenbaker, not necessarily on the other hand, but using different emphasis, stresses the cost. And the question then comes up, you know, well, what precisely is it? Is the bomber threat lessening, or is it the cost that you're really considering? And if the bomber, if the missile is going to be the new threat, why in hell are you getting the Bomarc, which is an anti-bomber matter? Now, I don't know if you want to comment on that or not.
I don't think so. That's just talk, I think. I think Diefenbaker and the whole conservative government at that time are looking for every reason they could find to give the public as to why they canceled the Arrow. Yeah. Whether they were valid or not.
Yeah.
I think really it was the cost of the program that had them scared.
I would agree with you. And again, having gone through the Harkness Papers, it is the cost that comes up time and time again. Cost, and that the Treasury is just jumping up and down.
Well, there were some pretty frightening numbers in there. I took over as general manager of the company, and let us say, for the sake of arguing, the 1st of January, 58.
Yeah.
It was a little before that. A review of next year's costs had been completed. You know, people who ran the Air Force budget and that sort of thing had all the costs that we thought we'd bring, the monies that we would require for the next fiscal year.
Yeah.
And everybody was quite happy about it. In reviewing it, however, we found that we'd left out some contract money for Minneapolis Honeywell for the the control damping system.
Control damping?
Yes. The system that stops the flutter.
Oh, I see.
Which is another of the supersonic problems, you see.
Yeah.
And looking it over, they threw at me a figure that we want another $1 million for this. Well, I said, I'm not really prepared to go up there now and say we want another $1 million. How much do we really want? Well, we had the vice president, general manager of Minneapolis Honeywell up, and a lot of the team down there. Then we had him up with his team, and we discussed it. We didn't want $1 million for the stamping system for the airplane, but $6 million. Now, this is a little bit of stuff that goes in the area. It's a big piece of equipment, too.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people that didn't even know it existed.
Yeah.
But we're in the big league, you see, when we're there.
I know.
And I don't think that even yet we're, as Canadians, we're conditioned to get into the big league in anything.
No. It seems to be the same psychological something with respect to the bobcat and the hydrofoil. And
the bobcat, the hydrofoil.
Yeah.
Well, there's so many of the things that we've really had the lead and haven't pressed on with it. The Havilland is a company that I feel that has never had the kind of support that it should have had. They invented the chipmunk.
Oh, yeah.
And we didn't want, the Air Force didn't want the chipmunk. We didn't need a trainer of that kind.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because we, the Canadians, wouldn't buy it, the Havilland had considerable difficulty selling it abroad. But they did sell it abroad.
Mm-hmm.
By the time that they'd run down their production line, sold it to the UK and various other countries. We finally need an airplane like the Chipmunk.
Mm-hmm.
The Havilland Canada's in no position to build as our requirement for Chipmunks, and we bought them from the UK.
Oh, no.
Yes, sir.
Oh, why didn't we buy them from the...
The Havilland's finished their production line.
They're through. Oh, I see.
Now, the Beaver. We didn't have a requirement for the Beaver. We didn't need to buy more than 3 or 4 to give the Havilland a good start.
Yeah.
They sold them on their own. sold in the United States Army in large quantities.
Yeah.
Now, it's true we came along later with the Otter.
Yeah.
But the Bobcat, one thing that the Americans came along and copied it, and we bought their machine after we'd abandoned ours. We never finished our design development. But the hydrofoil is a typical example. See, we got a successful vehicle, and we put it in mothballs. And we see American hydrofoil anchored off rail roads from time to time.
Yeah.
But you have to get into this thing and build it yourself and use it and show that it is really the top thing.
Yeah.
And even then you may have trouble convincing your competitors, particularly Americans, that they could buy it.
You took over in, of course, 57, December 57. And God knows you would have a great deal in your mind going from the Air Force to a civilian job and learning all about it and whatnot. But nevertheless, you would have even casual conversation with people, especially in the Air Force, people concerned with air defense. Wouldn't you be getting feelers in about some of the other stuff that was underway at the time? For example, well before you went to Avro Aircraft, you would have been hearing something about the Bomark, and probably you would have heard something read it in aviation magazines about the progress being made by the Bomark A and Bomark B. Did it ever cross your mind in 57 and 58 that these damn things might take over from the manned interceptor?
Not that they would take over from it. I couldn't imagine anybody being so stupid as to think that they would. They might be an adjunct to it.
But not ever take over?
No.
Again, from the idea that you have to see what the hell you want to shoot down.
You have to see something. You have to have some kind of reconnaissance.
Yeah.
And your Bomark, you see, a Bomark is absolutely contrary to my concept of the use of air power. It's a stationary thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've been brought up all my life that the great thing about air power is its flexibility.
Yeah.
Not immobility, that's a misnomer. It's not so mobile, but it is flexible.
Yeah.
You can take it and put it in various places.
Right.
Well, you know, anchor the thing to a Bomark site. You've got to go and build another site. A much more sophisticated site than a runway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I could never see the Bomark replacing the interceptor fighter. An adjunct to it, yes.
Yeah. And one thing I didn't realize, and that is that the two Bomark sites in Canada had other Bomarks. In other words, that was sort of there was a dual line here in the string of Bomarks. I had thought originally that there was just sort of, you know, single, single, single all the way across. There were an original, I forget how many was in the original lineup, and then this was reduced. But that the two it placed in Canada were placed there so it conformed to the general line. But I find that there are two up in Canada, fine, but there's a couple, several hundred miles to the south as well, which must be about the only place, in fact, I think it is the only place where you'd have a bit of a
double belt at it?
Yeah, a small double belt just in the Ontario Quebec area.
Oh, I really wouldn't know why they put them there.
I found that out incidentally, that's in James' weapons system, where they mentioned.
Yeah.
The whole bit, given, you know, the range.
Well, I think that the Bomark was part of the acquisition of the Bomark was because of the United States Air Force's great desire to have the Bomark brought into use as opposed to the Nike.
And I gather, too, that the NORAD agreement was sort of a package deal. In other words, the Yanks were going to have them, and even if there never were two in Canada, that the Yanks would still have them, and when the agreement was signed, it was sort of the mix that was accepted.
When did we announce we were going to have Bomarx? It was in September, wasn't it?
It was before the cancellation.
It was at the time of the Diefenbaker's speech in September, his press announcement in September. About that time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the time when they canceled the fire control system and the missile for the airplane.
Yeah.
At that time, they announced they were going to have a couple of Bomarx squadrons.
Yeah.
And the Bomarx got a bit of publicity at that time. It had hit a target at 400 miles or something like that. The only publicity Bomarx ever had.
Yeah. Oh God, they were in a fix too when they brought that up, especially when they. Well, you remember that long period when there were certain bugs in it, and they were firing off one damn Bomarx after another one, and not getting too much.
With it. Right.
Of course, the liberals found out about that, and then the Americans, you remember, they cut back on the Bomarx system just within a week or so of us getting it.
That's right.
And oh Christ, they were in a hell of a political position.
Well, it was an unfortunate thing. I think from what things that I've heard, Perks went down to Colorado Springs. I think he was probably in a last ditch stand, still trying to salvage the Arrow.
Yeah.
Trying to sell the Arrow.
Yeah.
I mean, at that time, the U.S. Air Force was selling the Bomarx like mad. The great battle was on to Bomarx versus Nike.
Yeah.
And he got exposed to the U.S. Air Force briefing team on the Bomarx at that time. And Campbell told me that he came back from that visit, he had a completely changed attitude towards the Arrow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe it was on that trip that he was told by one of the American Air Force generals that, insofar as the manned interceptor is concerned, that there'd be no problem whatsoever about Canada getting the manned interceptor. What do they call it?
106.
106, yeah.
No.
That if need be, etc.
Sure.
And you know, they'd be happy to. And of course, from a cost point of view, and certainly this
I guess that 106 would probably be delivered to us in $2.5 million or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, I suppose, that would be about it. But the 106 wasn't attached to the F-105, you see.
Well, how...
The F-105.
I know the CF-105 was better, but how much better?
Well, I can't say.
You know, I mean...
It's pretty hard to put a comparative.
Yeah.
It was a twin-engine airplane as opposed to being a single-engine airplane.
Yeah.
It was a two-seater airplane as opposed to being a single-seater airplane, and you would expect that you would get considerable more capability out of two men operating a piece of equipment than one in the all-weather role. So you might even say that it might be twice as good.
Yeah.
But twice as good as what?
I'll interrupt you later.
Oh, right on.
Sorry.
I've got an exam coming up.
Your exam at